Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Well, good morning, everybody. Today is Wednesday, January 29th, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. And our guest today is Orrin M. Levin-Waldman. He's a faculty member in the School of Public Affairs and Administration at Rutgers University in Newark, and a socioeconomic research scholar at Global Institute for Sustainable Prosperity Research. And you could learn more about him. He's got his own website, www.econlabor.com, for econlabor.com. So good morning, Professor. Great to have you on.
Good morning.
Well, you know, Professor, what's so hard to fathom is that people always diminish the voters, or they claim they're stupid and they don't know and they're ignorant of this and that and the other. But you point out that our politicians are playing with the voter. And does the voter actually realize that they're getting played, or don't they get it?
I think some voters realize they're being played, and others maybe have no clue, or they're willing to say, "Fine, if you can play me, what can you give me that's in my interest, and we'll take it from there." And you know, the American political system has always been this broker model, where basically you're trying to win an election, and whatever it takes to win the election, to get people to vote for you. So you promise whatever you can, that's in the voters' interest, or you think is in the voters' interest.
Well, was this like this in America as well, going back 100 years or 150 years or even further back? How did we evolve to the point where we're giving people what we that the elected officials think that people want in order for them to cast the vote for them? In other words, it's like you say, it's just this game. We'll give you what you want, and in return, you vote for us. Is that where it's at? Have we always had something that we got for free?
I think it's always been that way. More so since the advent of the welfare state, or a positive government, where government's performs more functions and delivers more goods in the form of programs. There's always been this attempt to win voters, and political parties never really stood for anything ideological. They simply moved in whichever direction that the electorate was moving in at any given period in time. So to a certain extent, it's always been this way, and it's probably one of the flaws in a representative democracy, so to speak, where basically you elect people to represent you, to serve as your agents, whereas in a more responsible party model, where you have proportional representation and parties are ideological, people are voting for specifically ideologically based governmental program, and they're voting for policies. That's not really the case here. You're only voting for policies that serve your interests. And basically, the policies and programs are means to an end. I think intuitively most people have understand this. They've always understood this, but I think it's getting worse now. We'll just promise anything under the sun just to get a vote, to win the election, that it may bankrupt the country down the road. That's not my concern, because I'll be out of office by the time it actually happens. So, we'll kick the can down the road for the next person to worry about.
So, I guess, there's no ideology, and yet we seem to be, like, in a baseball game, we're either for the Mets or for the Yankees. So we claim to be either Republican or Democrat or Independent, but that means absolutely nothing, because we're just looking for something that we'll get. Is that, you know, like, we have one candidate on the platform, I think he's going to be able to make the next campaign debate, this guy Yang, and he says he wants everybody to get I forgot the term now, where they earn $1,000 a month. and that's like a guaranteed salary. And is that just another way to buy people's vote? Is that work?
It probably is an attempt to buy votes. What he's promoting is a UBI, Universal Basic Income.
Yeah, right.
Which probably has some merit to it, given the movement of the economy towards more technologically based. In which case, if you raise wages too high, at least according to theory, you replace workers with machines. So then you need to provide them with some kind of income. And I've argued before that it could be a basis for making work more meaningful, redefining the nature of work. So if everybody had a UBI, then only those who really wanted to work at Walmart would work at Walmart, which would then force Walmart to actually pay wages that would attract people to work there. This kind of thing. If everybody had a UBI, maybe you'd have more physicians going into primary care as opposed to the highest-paying specialties because they wouldn't have to worry about paying back their loans. Maybe more attorneys would become going to public interest law. There could be benefits to society as a whole from a UBI, but the question is, how do you pay for it? And that's the question nobody seems to have a handle on. How we pay for these things, where the money is coming from, who gets taxed, those are, to a certain extent, they are somewhat ideologically based. They're also practically based. You tax those who have the money. But the party system in the U.S. has traditionally been a broker party model. Maybe it probably became a little more ideologically oriented during the Reagan years, where the Republicans basically were able to say, we are now the party of the right, and we believe in free markets and that kind of thing. And Democrats basically became the opposing party to that, whatever that means. Now, in the Clinton years, the Democratic Party sort of became the for centrist party, also openly embracing free markets, what we call neoliberal policy. And now what you have is the party system on the Republican side, it's moving towards the right, or at least it's maintaining its free market stance and clinging to its so-called ideology, if you can call it that, of tax cuts, deregulation, which is also a form of giving people goodies in exchange for their votes. And then the left, on the Democratic side, you have the movement towards the left. Let's just give people more things. We'll pay for it by taxing the wealthy, because the wealthy are not really entitled to what they've earned. So that's part of their ideology. So, we do have some ideology, but you still have an attempt to purchase votes.
So is in today's marketplace, is everything being driven by changes in our demographics? Were we more one as a nation in the past, and now we're split, we're all hyphenated something or another, we're a hyphenated American of some sort, and so are we doing this on ethnic lines, on color lines? Is it that well defined, or is it not?
Well, I mean, if you don't have an answer to pressing economic problems, I dare say nobody does, then you clearly play the identity politics card, which is clearly what the Democrats are doing. They're playing the different groups that have traditionally made up the coalition, and they're sort of, saying, look, we can give you this, we can give you that. The Republicans are doing the same thing. They don't call it identity politics, but when you basically appeal to an evangelical base, or you appeal to the pro-life group, that's a form of identity politics as well.
So how is it, for example, when we look back in the time that Hillary Clinton, supposedly she was supposed to be this wonderful new leader that failed, how is it that she failed? Did she fail because she wasn't giving enough away? But did Trump promise more? I mean, what was the rationale for one as opposed to the other? was it terms like Clinton calling the public deplorable and being so cynical of the voter?
I don't think that, well, it certainly didn't help for her to call voters who supported Trump deplorables. And that certainly reflects an elitist view of the world, which says that we are better than you, and you voters are really too stupid to understand how stupid you are. But I think the real issue in Trump's victory, and people will debate this, but I think the real issue is that Trump basically appealed to voters who are feeling a deep sense of anxiety over the economy, even though the economy may have been doing better for some, but he appealed to those who basically felt displaced as a function of changing economies, the loss of manufacturing. And if you look at data from particularly Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, which I did, it appears as though that what the answer seems to lie in the fact you've had a significant loss of manufacturing between 2008 and 2016. Now, you had a significant loss of manufacturing prior to 2008 as well, but there was also a loss between 2008 and 2016. At least that variable becomes statistically significant on a regression analysis. What was not an important variable was an increase in the number of, say, Mexicans living in those states. So that's statistically not significant. So the claim that Trump voters were motivated by racism is not supported by data. So that's point one. Then looking at those numbers again, what I discovered was that the percentage, the number of people in mining in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin was always relatively low. There was a significant increase, as much as 50% in Wisconsin and close to that in Pennsylvania. Now, if you're going to these states and telling these voters, get used to doing something else. If I'm elected president, I'm going to eliminate your jobs. Particularly the coal industry, that's not a winning strategy. And when the other candidate says, I'm not going to eliminate your jobs, I'm going to support the coal industry, then you can clearly understand why he would win in states which were clearly blue states, and they should have remained blue, not flip red. Now, the people will argue against this theory and say, well, really what happened in 2016 is a large percentage of the African-American vote that came out in 2008 wasn't there in 2016. So she lost African-American voters. Had the same proportion of African-American voters come out in 2016 as 2008, she probably would have won. I think there's an argument for both, but I think those who ignore the state of the economy and the transformations that have been occurring are making a huge mistake.
So is it appropriate to say that in this particular case, the platform by Trump was smarter than that of Hillary Clinton because he promised, I don't know if he delivered, I don't think he really delivered on saving all these jobs of people who thought that they might lose their job. And is that part of the deal with all politicians, to promise more than you could deliver? And even if you know that you really can't deliver, but it works, so it'll work for this particular term of office, it might work for a second, and so on and so forth. Depending what the limits are in a particular office. You know, I guess the president's only two terms. Other elected officials could be three or four, whatever.
Well,
so is that the way it works?
In part, it works that way. I think politicians are naturally let off the hook by the fact that they can promise anything they want. They know full well, and everybody else should understand that they may not deliver because it requires an action by Congress to deliver on some of those promises. If they don't have the votes in Congress to achieve those objectives, then they simply will not be achieved. So yeah, you can promise free college tuition all you want, and loan forgiveness, but that doesn't mean she's going to be able to deliver. But the fact is that it raises the bar in terms of expectations. Now, she promised this in 2016. Now, what
yeah.
In 2020, what can we expect in 2024? Now we have to start from a higher bar, you know, this kind of thing.
Yeah. Is that one of the problems that it's getting to the point where it's out of control, isn't it? Do we have the financial means to do all the things that people are espousing? I don't know if they're models to show that it's doable. I don't know. I really can't tell. I mean, these concepts sound good. If you could pay off, you know, it's interesting that quite often it's just like you can go to school and you can go to colleges and you can get your education. But it's going to be at no cost. But then on the other hand, it doesn't seem that we ask anybody who gets a free education to, let's say, invest 10 years of their life, in a sense, to pay off that cost and maybe not earn as much as somebody who has already, you know, has got has been around for more than 10 years or so. So they have seniority, and therefore they can earn more return on the money. But does that not work? Like if you're earning 150 grand, can you not survive in 75 or 50,000 until you pay off your 4-year term in school and pay that off?
Well, I mean, there are other questions that need to be addressed as well. Just if we provide everybody with a free college tuition education, what's the guarantee that our new college graduates who went to school debt-free will get good jobs, that will get jobs that pay them well?
Right.
What's the guarantee that they won't be passed over in the marketplace for people who still graduated from the elite schools? Who are perceived
right.
to be better or, you know, more have greater aptitude. So those are questions which are not addressed by those who are pushing free college tuition. Then you still have the moral issue, which was kind of raised on the campaign trail by somebody who said, look, what about those of us who played by the rules? We saved and we put our children through college. They are debt-free.
Right.
And what about us? Are you going to pay us back for our contributions? And her response was, no. You owe something to other people. That's not the way they view things.
Well, her response was basically to say, okay, well, everybody needs to help everybody else. Is that the way our system is set up? We're individuals, aren't we? And if we do well, then we do well. And if we don't do well, then we just don't do as well as others. There's no balance here, is there? Not everybody gets a guaranteed amount of money, and everyone buys a house, and everybody's got a car, and everyone can go to school, and so on and so forth. Those are the choices that we have to make.
The American economic system is based on the pursuit of selfish self-interest. And basically, the idea that I owe something to my neighbor is not something contained in neoclassical economics. We have a long history of me for myself and only for myself. Now, if you want to support organizations to give to others, then there's something called private charities, and people can do that because they're motivated out of moral authority, and the religious teachings or whatever. But this idea that you owe something to everybody else, that we now live in this larger community and we're all members of the same larger community, is sort of an anathema to the American political system. Maybe that's the case in more European countries where you sort of have a corporate entity that people have an allegiance to the corporate hall as opposed to individuals themselves. Now, basically, Adam Smith basically summed it up well when he says, by pursuing your self-interest in a marketplace where you have an invisible hand of competition, that will ultimately result in self-interest being harnessed towards the attainment of the larger public good.
What happens, for example, when you have an anomaly? Let's say, like, if we look at the Soviet Union, there are people who are literally in poverty. They don't have jobs and stuff like that. But they have an autocratic ruler and controls everything. And then you also have people who can still afford to have a summer home and big houses in big cities. So they seem to be doing all right. Are those some of the things that Bernie Sanders talks about, where he wants to – is that what he talks about when he talks about socialism? Is that what he's trying to, you know, to bring into the American landscape? But are we Scandinavia? Are we going to be able to do it that way?
No, we're not Scandinavia, and we're also not Cuba.
Right.
Bernie Sanders seems to have a lot of respect for the Cuban medical system. That, you know, if doctors aren't paid well, or people are not treated as individuals, they don't have a choice. That's great. That's fine, because they're all equal, as far as Bernie Sanders is concerned. So that's okay. Now, the fact that he's a member of Congress and he has wonderful benefits that nobody else has is sort of irrelevant.
Mm. Absolutely. And then when he looks at Cuba and he gloats over their success as far as graduating doctors, Cuba doesn't know what to do with those doctors, so they ship them abroad. So they're in Venezuela and Brazil and so on and so forth, and they're working there. And they're working there for a pittance, because they get paid by the Cuban government, and also by the host nation that they're working in. But that doesn't work either, does it? Because I know that I was reading about in Brazil, the Cuban doctors are being pushed out because they've got their own doctors who are Brazilian and not Cuban. So I don't know how this is supposed to work out. Is there a system out there that actually functions better, is more attuned to not only what the people want, but also attuned to the reality of their financial state of health in a nation? Or is that just, that's absurd?
It's a dialectic, and I'm not sure, you know, how you resolve that. You have forces moving in two different directions, but the issue is that, you know, you can't sustain, you know, the Scandinavian health system unless you're willing to overtax people, and at some point your economy suffers. That's something they're realizing in these countries that have been overly generous. On the other hand, you know, in a free marketplace, it's not the case that everybody will have, you will not have universal health care, and you will not, and people who can't afford it will not get, and then people will go bankrupt trying to pay for their medical services. So you can't have that either.
Yeah.
So you need to find some balance somewhere. It's not going to be in Medicare for all. I mean, you know, I understand what they're trying to say here, but you can't have a Medicare for all system juxtaposed with the current private insurance regime. And you can't necessarily...
Isn't that what it's all about? It's the corporate greed, isn't it?
That's exactly what it's about. The corporate greed, which they blame the doctors for, their corporate greed, the insurance companies. But you know, you can't simply do that. Either you're going to have a single payer system, or you're going to have a fully market based private insurance system, which is not employer-based, but individuals buy their own insurance, which would then force competition in the marketplace, where insurance companies would then have to lower their prices in order to attract purchasers. Now, the other thing that you could do is you could go back to an older system that we had where people would buy catastrophic insurance plans, the old Blue Shield,
mm-hmm.
Blue Cross plans of 40 years ago, whatever it was, whereby, you know, it covers you for hospitalization, but, you know, regular routine doctor's visits and lab work, you pay out of pocket.
Yeah.
Which basically would solve a lot of problems. Again, if once you're hospitalized and you are on the hook for a large bill, that's not the deductible. But on the other hand, if doctors knew their patients are paying out of pocket, they may be able to spend. They could build a practice without having to rely on low reimbursements from insurance companies. They could actually spend more time with their patients, which may actually improve patient care. So, you know, there are a lot of arguments on all sides, but nobody is really addressing those. They're just simply responding to slogans. I don't have insurance. Okay, he's promising Medicare for all. I've got a Cadillac plan with my union. I'm not voting for him.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to, like, the medical business and the drugs, why are we paying so much more in drugs? Couldn't we lower that? But is that part of our support of corporate America and corporate drug manufacturers? Because other countries manufacture the same stuff, and it costs a lot less to produce. We're probably the highest cost in medication than anywhere else in the world. And we subsidize so much against the rest of the world. Is that part of our problem, too? We're subsidizing so much all over the world?
Well, you're subsidizing all over the world. You're also subsidizing manufacturers here, basically under the pretext, well, unless they are guaranteed a certain return on their investment, they won't invest into research.
Hmm. And that's supposed to fly? And evidently it does.
Well, if you're basically telling people that they cannot purchase drugs from out of the country, or their insurance companies won't cover it, Then that's basically creating a problem in restraint of free trade. And the other issue is you're not enforcing anti-monopoly laws in this country. You know, when CVS can purchase Aetna, basically that's a monopoly in restraint of free trade.
So basically,
if you are a person who has head insurance, you're in effect being told you cannot purchase your drugs from the Rite Aid or the Walgreens, only from CVS, because that's the only pharmacy that your insurance company will pay for.
And what's the rationale for keeping that? Because all of a sudden in this year's budget, the state, New York State, is seeing, I think it was $6.1 billion deficit, and much of it had to do with increased costs in taking care of people from a medical perspective. So all these things are costing a fortune, and we're already in a deficit situation just on that alone. And there are others from the past that are still, you know, promises that have yet to be delivered. And we still also need to build infrastructure and so many other things. There are all kinds of wonderful plans, but does it respond to what the public wants and needs?
I don't know if anybody's really concerned with what the public wants or needs. It's basically politicians telling them they think this is what they should need. And so they know better than the public. It's sort of the elitist mentality, which says, I'm smarter than you, and I'll tell you what you need. And if you're not convinced of it, I'll try to raise enough money to stick enough money into advertising dollars to convince you this is what you truly need.
Yeah. Hmm. Wow. And then I know that they say a lot of people, particularly close to the Canadian border, that's a long border, you know, in the north, the northern part of our nation and with Canada, And many of them travel there in groups, actually, and to get their medication. Do we disallow them to send drugs to the United States, even though the costs are cheaper? How come we don't allow that competition to take place? So are we protected that way from, you know, less expensive drugs that are made there? Exactly the same formula, I understand.
Well, yeah, basically in a system where you offer goodies and benefits through the tax code, and you that much open the door up for lobbying activity on the part of by corporations to get their wares, yeah, you can basically force Congress to pass laws protecting certain industries and that kind of thing. And it's one of the problems that I've suggested in the past is when if you really wanted to have a serious tax reform and get rid of a lot of your interest groups, you would basically have flat taxes with no deductions, no loopholes.
Mm-hmm.
And basically industries that can't survive without loopholes, I guess they would go under, but if they really had a good product to sell, they would survive. But you would also get rid of a lot of interest groups. The problem with interest groups is that also balloons the budget. So what you're seeing now with different politicians promising this, that, and everything else under the sun is that basically it's a form of distributive politics whereby everybody benefits somehow because everybody gets something in terms of the budget, but everybody also pays for it too. You can't easily identify the winners and the losers, which you could do typically when you're talking about regulatory politics or redistributive politics, whereby in regulatory policy, you obviously identify those who are going to be the beneficiaries of the regulation. You can sort of identify those who will be paying the cost. In redistributive politics, you clearly are know who that derives the benefit of redistribution, and you know exactly who bears the cost, and that's usually where a lot of your political infighting comes from in any given election over regulatory and redistributive politics. Distributive politics is more interesting because basically you can't easily identify those who are bearing the cost. We all bear the cost, and basically it's the reason why budgets balloon, because everybody is promising something to purchase votes.
Yeah, evidently that's the case. What is there a way to balance this out, or are we just stuck on this particular trajectory that is not functioning from a financial perspective, from every other way too? Because if it's not financial, everything is derived actually, I guess, from money, and. So everyone seems to be suffering. And why do we think that we can get all the money from the rich? They're going to be able, as you mentioned in your article, they're going to be able to weasel out from that because they've got experts who know how to, work the system. They know what they get away with and what they can't get away with. They also know how to hide money as well. And we don't have enough money to hide. So something seems to be there's a fault line here, and it almost seems incongruous in my mind that we've gotten to this point, and it seems to have gotten worse, I would think, in the last 20 some odd years, maybe longer. It's very hard to rationalize in my mind. So where do we go from here? Or are we just going to continue on the same route? You know, voting for people who promise us something, and whether they deliver or not, that'll be the decision whether we vote for them again.
I don't see any way out of this in the near future. But the remedy is really more structural than anything else. You either restructure the government, restructure the constitutional system, try to educate people on the true meaning of democracy and what it requires, its responsibility on the part of the voters to be informed, not to sit there passively waiting for something to come their way in exchange for their votes. I don't see the any way out of it. You perhaps could lessen the impact if you had maybe a more responsible party system. But that, again, that requires a structural change in a representative system whereby you basically would no longer have single-member districts. You would have provinces or districts which has multi-members, so several members of a party or several parties could represent a particular district. So you'd have proportional representation. And that's very much anathema to our political system. I don't see that flying anytime soon. I don't see anybody supporting a constitutional amendment to bring that about.
Well, it's interesting also in the article you point out that a part of the arrogance of the system is where now we're slugging it out to try to impeach the president, whether you like him or not. The point is it actually undermines what the majority had voted for last time round, even though some people resent it. But that's the outcome. Isn't that what we're supposed to accept? And if we don't like it, we can actually vote somebody else into office, assuming that there's someone more compelling than this particular president. And why don't we move along those lines? And why are we fighting every conceivable way other than what seemed to be legitimate years ago?
That's your supreme irony here, isn't it? Basically, you're saying, look, we, the elites, that have basically decided this president needs to go. Actually, we decided he needs to go before he was elected or before he was sworn in.
Yeah.
But they're basically saying we don't care for what the masses have to say, but the electorate. They're wrong. We decide they're wrong.
Yeah.
And no matter what they say, they're wrong, and he has to go. So we don't accept the will of the public. And basically, they had no right to vote in the first place because they were, well, deplorable, according to Hillary Clinton. So basically, when you support an impeachment as your mechanism for redressing the past election, or simply, you know, you want to remove him prior to the next election, what they're doing is defying the will of the public. And I think they're actually twisting what Alexander Hamilton said in the Federalist Papers. I don't think he really said what the Democratic managers basically attribute to him. But that's a whole different matter. He recognized that certain acts, for example, a veto exercised by the chief executive is an anti-majoritarian impulse. Impeachment is also an anti-majoritarian impulse. You're basically saying democracy is not something we think is convenient for us. Now, in so doing, what they are also doing is they're interfering with the next election themselves. They're trying to tip the scales in their favor. So, you know, whether he asked the Ukrainians to help him, what he didn't ask the Ukrainians to help him, is kind of irrelevant. I mean, he can ask him for anything he wants. It's no guarantee it will help him. Two, there's no guarantee that Joe Biden would be his rival in the next election. So he'd be wasting his efforts. But the larger point, it doesn't really rise to the level of impeachable offenses. In this respect, I agree with Alan Dershowitz on this particular issue.
And then I'm wondering about all these different situations. Well, you know, it's hard for me to fathom. Like, are we also playing this game as well where, for example, I hear that the president wants to pass some sort of legislation that you, or maybe it was in New York State, if you didn't pay your taxes, you would lose the right to vote. And so in other words, you had to pay your back taxes in order to be able to have the right to vote. And what is that supposed to do? Is that supposed to diminish those people who had some financial problems in the past in order to get rid of a group of people who might think in a particular way? Are we making judgment calls on how people are going to vote based on their financial circumstance?
I find it hard to believe
that. Are there identity politics?
Well, there's certainly that there, but I think that that would probably be ruled unconstitutional. But basically, in creating invidious classifications, you're basically bringing back, in effect, the poll tax, or bringing back the concept of property qualification for the right of franchise, which was just away with a long time ago. So if you have property, you have the wealth and the ability to pay, then you vote. Now, arguably, if you've been convicted of not paying your taxes,
yeah.
Then you're a felon. That's a whole different issue. Many cases, convicted felons don't get the vote. But if they're simply saying you're in the rears, therefore, and we decide to accuse you, and maybe you have paid your taxes, and we just can't find the records of it, then I think it's a serious problem.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So where do we go at the moment? The election is looming. The impeachment process will soon be over, I would tend to think, maybe in a week or two, or the most maybe a month, and then it's like full steam ahead, isn't it, with the election process? We still have a lot of Democrats vying for political office, but that seems to be diminishing as well. And so where does one go? And the president still as belligerent as ever. You know, so he demonizes a lot of people. And is that the winning game? I mean, he's done very well with it, but I don't know if others are up to this challenge.
I personally don't think it's a winning game. I don't think it's a great strategy, but I think, you know, being slick back and smooth and, you know, Bob Farhead is not a winning strategy either, and people are tired of that. They're tired of being lectured by the likes of Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and Michael Bloomberg on how they ought to behave.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that that's one of the appeals that Trump has to these people, even though he really isn't of them. He too was a different. He's of an elite too, of a different sort, of an economic elite. And I don't think, you know, he is the successful businessman he claims to be. My guess is that the reason why we haven't seen his tax returns is because it would show he's leveraged to the hilt. So he's actually basically living on borrowed money. So if you're talking about somebody who says, I'll take care of the deficit, but obviously he can't take care of his own, that becomes a serious problem. But, you know, I think you can't win. It's not a great strategy to win an election by insulting everybody. And I think that's part of the problem that he's having here with impeachment. I think, you know, he doesn't make it easy for himself. He's sort of given them a handle on things by constantly taking to Twitter and insulting people. I think that just sort of he's not helping himself.
Yeah, I don't think so. Well, it's interesting, you know, in France, everyone that's that rises to the top as president, they all come from the best schools. The same thing in the UK, you know, everyone went to Eton and or seemingly so. And here in the United States, we don't have that same sort of system. But why are we falling, you know, for all these very wealthy millionaires or billionaires? Why are we going in that direction? Because at one time we were concerned that maybe interest groups would buy these the elections by giving money to a particular candidate. Now these candidates don't need anybody's money. They can run their own campaign. But why are we enamored to that? Are we looking to somebody who's extremely well-educated as opposed to someone who's got a lot of money?
I don't know if it's so much the money or it's the right social class as epitomized by the type of school that you've gone to. So I mean, there's always been that here, and for some reason the elites only believe that people who graduate from Harvard, Princeton, or Yale should be running for president.
Yeah.
And you know, we sort of had this. This whole debate if anybody remembers, going back to when George W. Bush was president, I think he wanted to nominate his legal counsel, Harriet Myers, to the Supreme Court. And everybody was screaming, he can't do that. She was criticized from people, particularly on the left, by saying she's not qualified, she doesn't have the right credentials, she doesn't have experience as a judge. What they're really saying is she only graduated from Southern Methodist University Law School. She didn't have the credentials everybody else who went to Harvard, who clerked for Supreme Court justice and so on and so forth. So basically it was the claim of the elite saying, we only really want people who come from our particular social class, who graduated from the right institutions to be public officials or be appointed to courts or appointed to cabinet-level positions. Now, basically, during the Clinton years, you had a lot of that going on. You had two categories, friends of Bill and friends of Hill. And both sets of friends were people they knew, mostly from Yale Law School. And if you went to Yale Law School and you were either a friend of Hill or Bill, you were likely to get an appointment to a cabinet-level position or the court.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. So really nothing has changed, as you pointed out in the very beginning of the broadcast. But it seems we're pushing up the intensity of it more. And by all this freebies that are being presented and offered to the voter, they're going to vote for that because it's to their self-interest, as you pointed out. And so is the system really broken down all that much? Did we do this in the 1950s or the 1970s or in the early 1900s or before that? Why were we not so, I guess, I don't know what the right word is, we just wanted more and more and more. We were a little bit reluctant to get all these freebies. Was that part of the American way of wanting to pick yourself up by your own bootstraps?
You had different freebies from different candidates in different forms. The age of Andrew Jackson was look, you know, vote for me and you get a job while working for government. It was the old spoils system. You would be rewarded with a position. Then the next person comes into office and says, fine, vote for me. I'll give you a job too. I'll fire the people who voted for my opponent and I'll hire you instead. Thomas Jefferson, I don't think he was told in terms of buying votes, but he certainly believed in this idea of an agrarian economy. His whole justification for the Louisiana Purchase, which technically was unconstitutional, and could have resulted in his impeachment. But his whole justification for it was, I'm going to save the Republic by acquiring territory, expanding westward, allowing people to be yeoman farmers. So the reason for this is so we can acquire land, give it to people so they can become yeoman farmers independent. That was his whole justification. Now, if you pass homesteading laws to allow for that, then that's essentially what you're doing. You are, if you're not purchasing their vote in the immediate short term, you are purchasing their loyalty in the long term, so that they will at least in the future vote for people who subscribe to the same ideology.
Well. So where do we go from here? We're going to continue the way we've been doing it for a long time, and the extras are going to just come in and be grander and worth more to the individuals. Are we going to give out more food stamps? Are we going to give out more benefits somewhere else? Health plans and so on and so forth. What else is missing?
You will give out whatever you feel is necessary to get the vote in your particular congressional or senatorial district. Now, if you want to give out more food stamps, that you'll have no opposition from Republican members of Congress from the Farm Belt, because food stamps is an agricultural program. It's not a Health and Human Services program. So it benefits farmers.
Okay, they're not doing so well in the last few years, and the same thing with food crops and cattle and so on and so forth. Is everything under assault now? What have we done? Have we overspent our way?
It certainly has not helped, but you know, arguably you could say, look, reaching some kind of trade deal, even if it's an interim trade deal with the Chinese, to help the farmers as a way of purchasing their support too.
Mm-hmm. Well, also the world is going through a retraction or contraction rather, and there's going to be a lot of competition from all over the place. And we've also made big mistakes, you know, like the Boeing disaster with 737. I read today that they expect an $18 billion loss because of this fiasco. And that was part of the corporate greed as well. And then what about the banking system? Is it really functioning well, or are we under assault there as well? And even the automotive industry is not doing so well because we're going through transitions now, trying to electrify everything. And I don't know if that's going to work either. A lot of companies are under assault. You know, they say Ford may not survive if they can't do it fast enough and they don't get a partner. So where do we look that's like a positive thing on the horizon, or is there not one at the moment?
I don't have answers to that. as far as auto industry is concerned, part of me says, you know, look, if they could not take the long view of these things, or they assume they could continue to get, you know, protective legislation, that would be the response to most problems. That really was not a great way to, that was not a great winning strategy, but that's been their modus operandi, and that's what you do in a society which is driven by interest groups. And that's what we have. And that's, to be perfectly honest about it, that was the political system by design. That is called what we call the Madisonian system. He assumed that there'd be so many interest groups. He thought that because you'd have so many interest groups, it would be hard to find, to locate the common good or the common interest. Therefore, by default, the common interest would rise to the top because, you know, you would never get a consensus on what it was. By default, the government would really do very little. They legislate very little, or whatever legislation that they would accomplish would be incremental, ultimately, meaning that your liberty would be preserved and protected. But I don't know that he quite saw the growth of giant corporations that could hire put unlimited amounts of money into lobbying activities and put unlimited amounts of money into contributions to political campaigns.
Well, the big corporations, the ones that are doing well, they may lobby for, you know, subsidies, and which they get a lot of. But at the same time, is the basic driver right now, even though they thought there would be so many different interests that there wouldn't be one, but aren't we also working for new immigrants that just got they became the citizenship? Are we buying a lot of, you know, people who normally didn't have any say or sway in our elected officials? Is that part of it?
That's part of it.
I mean, I'm not trying to demonize them, but I just think that, you know, it looks like we're looking to the lower classes in order to have and use their vote. So it's one man, one vote, and they have more votes than, let's say, the more established and very well-to-do. And the only way to change that equation is for the well-off to spend the money in advertising to persuade people not to go that route.
Right, but what you're doing is, and this basically follows the argument of Anthony Downs as an economic theory of democracy, you're basically trying to increase the money utility of low-income voters, or maybe low-income
uh-huh.
voters who are now extending into the lower rung of the middle class, or even the middle
yeah.
class. But you're trying to do that in exchange for the votes. You're basically purchasing their quiescence. This
yeah.
frees you up to pursue policy which is favorable to the moneyed interest, the more affluent, because that's the
yeah.
way you remain in power.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's not clear. So on one hand, you say, okay, Medicare for all, free college tuition, loan forgiveness. But green energy may not be in the best interest of many workers who will lose their jobs.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But it would be in the interest of those who are going to make millions or billions selling shares on the stock exchange.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that seems to be the shining light as far as the president is concerned. The stock market's doing well, but are people doing well? It looks like the economy is not doing as well as we thought. But who knows when the figures are going to turn around in a negative way, but right now they're holding up. But I don't know if that's legitimate or not. So we'll have to wait and see. Well, it looks like we're in for a long haul struggle, and we'll see where this goes. Can you see? Do you have a crystal ball, or is that a little cloudy at the moment?
I think it's very cloudy at the moment.
Well, Professor, as usual, very, very compelling. Thank you very, very much. And I'll wish you goodbye and a good day. In the meantime, I'll get back to tell people about some of the books that you've already published and the different essays that they can get a hold of, including the one that you just put together for this particular show. So thank you again.
Thank you.
All the best. Bye. Well, there we have it, folks, none other than Professor Oren M. Levin-Waldman. And what we're going to do is let's look at some of the stuff that he's done. Very accomplished author as well. And, well, one thing that you can do is if you want to learn more about his policies and concepts and elaborations on different subject matter, you might want to go to his website, www.econlabor.com. So that's www.econlabor.com, and you'll be able to find all the information that we spoke about and more. Well, he's also written a book called Restoring the Middle Class through wage policy. I don't know what's wrong with me today. I don't feel like I'm totally in control of my mind. So he's the author of Restoring the Middle Class Through Wage Policy, and those are arguments for a middle class. And that was published by Palgrave, and that's available through any bookstore and online or through a regular store and a brick and mortar store. And then he wrote another book called Understanding Public Policy in the United States. This one was published by TopHat.com, and all these are listed, so with a link to how you can get these books if you want to. And then the first time I met him was in reading the book called The Minimum Wage, a Reference Handbook, and that was really a fantastic piece, and I think it's worth reading. At least I was able to understand it. Some of this stuff is so esoteric, I think it goes way beyond my capacity. Maybe I just don't devote enough time, but you know, I'm revisiting his work because it's so compelling. Anyway, so the minimum wage or reference handbook published by ABC-CLIO, so ABC-CLIO.com. And then he had another one, which is now also in paperback. It's called Wage Policy, Income Distribution, and Democratic Theory. And this is published by Routledge, R-O-U-T-L-E-D-G-E, so Routledge.com. And really another excellent read. And then he did a follow-up on the case of the minimum wage competing policy models. And this was published by the State University of New York Press. So you could find them at sunypress.edu. And again, the professor, Orrin M. Levin-Waldman, is a faculty member in the School of Public Affairs and Administration at Rutgers University, Newark. He's also the socioeconomic research scholar at Global Institute for Sustainable Prosperity Research. And again, his website, econlabor.com. So, and it's just really terrific. So there are a lot of things you could read and look at his essays. I think you'll find them very, very fascinating. And I guess that's the story there. What we'll do is, I see it's already 11 o'clock. What we'll do is we'll go over to the studio screen. Bear with me a moment here. And when we do there, where is it here? Yeah, here we are. What we'll do is we'll go over to a commercial break, find out what's going on at the Yonkers Tribune, and then we'll be back.
The Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome, equipped with a digital camera and a stenopad at all times. Hezzy is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. The Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hezzy, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. Please call Hezzy Aris at 914-562-0834 or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
Welcome back. So if you're interested in reaching out to the Yonkers Tribune, you could reach them at one number now, another number which is good for their office, for their cell number, for the text number, and for the voicemail. And that number is 347-415-4326. So 347-415-4326. Well, the latest information that just came out, Syria's last major opposition bastion has been crushed. So the question is, what's next? So the Syrian government's recapture today of the key highway town of Ma'arat al-Numan is the latest step in a regime push to retake the opposition's last major bastion. So how important is the town to the Damascus government? What's left of the ever-shrinking region, largely dominated by Syria's former al-Qaeda affiliate, though other opposition groups are also present, and where are regime forces likely to move in next? The question is it a major blow? Russia-backed government forces have retaken large parts of Syria from rebels and jihadists since 2015 and now control around 70% of the country. Over the past year, regime forces have upped their deadly bombardment of the last major bastion of Idlib region in northwest Syria, slowly chipping away at it from the south. Now, the latest key town to fall is Ma'arat al-Numan, which lies on the key M5 highway, which links the capital to a second city and once industrial hub called Aleppo. Now, the regime's recapture of Ma'arat al-Numan is a major symbolic and strategic blow to the Syrian opposition. That's what Syria analyst Samuel Rahmani had said. Ma'arat al-Numan has been a nerve center for popular unrest against President Bashar al-Assad's government since the start of the revolution in 2011. The town's recapture brings the government a step closer to recapturing the whole of the M5 highway long in its sights as it seeks to revive Syria's ailing economy. Now, Sam Heller of the International Crisis Group said it was part of a long-term government strategy. Quote, Damascus is evidently determined to retake the key highways crisscrossing Idlib and linking other, more economically relevant parts of Syria, he said. So what's left? Now Ma'arat al-Numan has been retaken. The rebel bastion has shrunk to just over half of Idlib province, as well as adjacent slivers of Aleppo and Latakia, according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. It's home to some 3 million people, half of whom have been displaced from other parts of the country. The spike in violence against the start of December has seen more than 388,000 people displaced from their homes in Idlib and western Aleppo. That's what the United Nations has said. And that adds to some 400,000 already displaced by deadly bombardment unleashed in late April of last year. Now, many who fled their homes have sought refuge along the Turkish border, setting up makeshift shelters among the olive trees. And Nicholas Heras of the Institute for the Study of War said that the regime is likely trying to corner anti-government forces near the frontier with rebel backer Turkey. Assad's forces are carefully being directed by Russia to capture significant territory up to the strategic M5 highway in order to box the Syrian rebels into a rump zone from the highway to the Turkish border. Now, the outcome, according to Heras, is an inevitable regime victory. So the question is, what's next? After Wednesday's victory, today's victory, some 50 kilometers, about 30 miles, of the M5 remain outside regime control, the British-based observatory said. Heller said it was a near certainty that regime forces will next move towards Salakib, the next town northwards on the coveted M5. Salakib, he points out, also sits at the junction of the M4, which runs west to east across Idlib, linking the coastal regime stronghold of Latakia to Aleppo. Russian and regime warplanes in recent days have bombed Salakib and surrounding towns and villages, according to the observatory, in what may be a prelude to a land assault. The monitor says that battles are currently raging with 10 kilometers, that's about 6 miles, of the town, which has been near emptied of its inhabitants by a mass exodus that began on January 24. Oh my God, so a lot of stuff's going on. Now let's move on to here what's happening in the U.S. Evidently, a battle is looming over witnesses as the defense rests in the Trump impeachment trial. President Donald Trump's impeachment trial is shifting to questions from senators, a pivotal juncture as Republicans lack the votes to block witnesses and face a potential setback in their hope of ending the trial with a quick acquittal. After Trump's defense team rested on Tuesday with a plea to end now, quote unquote, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell privately told senators he did not yet have the votes to brush back Democratic demands for witnesses now that revelations from John Bolton, the former National Security Advisor, have roiled the trial. Bolton writes in a forthcoming book that Trump told him he wanted to withhold military aid from Ukraine until it helped with investigations into Democratic rival Joe Biden. And that assertion, if true, would undercut a key defense argument and go to the heart of one of the two articles of impeachment against the president. Quote, I think Bolton probably has something to offer us, said Senator Lisa Murkowski. She's a Republican from Alaska. Not in Trump's view. Quote, Why didn't John Bolton complain about this nonsense, quote unquote, a long time ago when he was very publicly terminated? Trump tweeted shortly after midnight. He said, not that it matters, nothing. So the uncertainty about witnesses arises days before crucial votes on the issue. In a Senate split 53-47 in favor of the Republicans, at least four GOP senators must join all Democrats to reach the 51 number required to call witnesses, decide whom to call, or do nearly anything else in the trial. Several Republicans apparently are ready to join Democrats in calling witnesses. The 2 days set aside for questions Wednesday and Thursday, that's today and tomorrow, also allow each side more time to win over any undecided senators pondering the witness issue. In the meantime, all will have the opportunity to grill both the House Democrats prosecuting the case and the president's defense team, held to submitting written questions to be read by Chief Justice John Roberts. Senators are expected to dig into the big themes of the trial, among them whether what Trump did or may have done rises to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors, as well as pointed and partisan attacks on each side's case. Trump faces charges from Democrats that he abused his power like no other president, jeopardizing U.S.-Ukraine relations by using the military aid as leverage while the vulnerable ally battled Russia. And Democrats say that Trump then obstructed their probe in a way that threatens the nation's three-branch system of checks and balances. The president's legal team tried to lock up its case on Tuesday and convince GOP senators that the president was right to ask Ukraine for investigations of Biden and his son Hunter, and was well within his power to block the aid. And they said he was not bound to abide by the congressional investigation. But Trump complained anew, at least on Tuesday, yesterday night, in Wildwood, New Jersey, charging that congressional Democrats are obsessed with demented hoaxes, crazy witch hunts, and deranged partisan crusades. A Trump attorney, Jay Sekulow, addressed the Bolton controversy head-on, closing arguments by dismissing the former National Security Advisor's manuscript as inadmissible. And attorney Alan Dershowitz, the Harvard scholar, said earlier that even if Bolton's story is true, the actions don't rise to an impeachable offense. Well, Senate Republicans spent considerable time in private discussion how to deal with Bolton's manuscript without extending the proceedings or jeopardizing the president's expected acquittal. That effort lost steam as Democrats showed no interest. Minority Leader Chuck Schumer saying, quote, we're not bargaining with them. And GOP senators were warned that if they agree to call Bolton or try to access his manuscript, the White House will block him, likely sparking a weeks-long court battle over executive privilege and national security. Nonetheless, Senator Mitt Romney of Utah and Susan Collins of Maine appear to be backed by others in the move to seek more testimony. Some Republicans, including Senator Pat Toomey, want reciprocity, bringing in Bolton or another Democrat witness in exchange for one thing from the GOP camp or GOP side. And some Republicans want to hear from Biden and his son, who was in a horde of I lost his place here for a moment. Some Republicans want to hear from Biden and his son, who was on the board of a Ukrainian gas company, Burisma, when its father was vice president. Quote, if people want witnesses, we're going to get a lot of witnesses, said Republican Senate Lindsey Graham, one of Trump's strongest defenders in the Senate. He said they would want to know was it legitimate, quote, was it legitimate for the president to believe there was corruption and conflicts of interest on the Biden's part in the Ukraine, end quote. Well, those swaps, though, seem likely to fall, as most Republican senators don't want to call Bolton, and most Democrats would rather avoid dragging the Bidens further into the impeachment proceedings. The Bidens were a focus of defense arguments, though no evidence of wrongdoing has emerged. Now, I don't know that the manuscript would make any difference in the outcome of the trial, said Roy Blunt of Missouri. He's a member of the GOP leadership. And some Republicans said they simply don't trust Bolton's word. Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky called Bolton disgruntled and seeking to make money off his time at the White House. But John Kelly, that's Trump's former White House chief of staff, told an audience in Sarasota, Florida, that he believed Bolton. If John Bolton says that in the book, I believe John Bolton, he said. White House officials privately acknowledged that they are essentially powerless to block the book's publication, but could sue after the fact if they believed it violated the confidentiality agreement Bolton signed. Trump and his lawyers have argued repeatedly that Democrats are using impeachment to try to undo the results of the last presidential election and drive Trump from office. What they are asking you to do is to throw out a successful president on the eve of an election, said White House counsel Pat Cipollone. Democrats, meanwhile, say that Trump's refusal to allow administration officials to testify only reinforces that the White House is hiding evidence, and the White House has had Bolton's manuscript for about a month, according to a letter from Bolton's attorney. So, my goodness, there's so much that is going on. This is very interesting as well. Outrage as Roman Polanski's new film tops the French Oscar nomination. Roman Polanski's new film, An Officer and a Spy, topped the list of the list of nominations on Wednesday for the French Oscars that are known better as the Caesars, sparking fury from feminists. Controversial director has been wanted in the United States for the statutory rape of a 13-year-old girl since 1978 and is persona non grata in Hollywood. His period drama about the Dreyfus case, which rocked France at the turn of the 20th century, is in line with 12 Caesars, the French equivalent of the Oscars. Now, the head of the French Film Academy, Alain Telzian, said it, quote, should not take moral positions, end quote, about giving awards. But their choice was swiftly condemned by feminists and some film critics. If rape was an art, give all the Caesars to Polanski, tweeted the French women's group, Ose la Feminisme, or Dare to be Feminist. And by celebrating a fugitive rapist and child sex criminal, we silence the victims, added the group, which said it would demonstrate outside the awards ceremony on February 28th. British film critic Casper Salmon was equally scathing. The Caesar Awards are literally inviting an actor who was a victim of sexual abuse or sexual assault by a director when she was a child. Her name is Adele Haenel. And the director who sexually abused the child, Roman Polanski, to be the same in the same room together for a big celebration of the film. So Haenel, who was nominated for Best Actress in her performance in Portrait of a Lady on Fire, touched a nerve last year by telling how she was sexually harassed at the age of 12 on her first film. French director Christophe Rougia was charged with sexual assault in a minor earlier this month. Polanski, who's 86, won both Best Director, and the Critics' Prize at the Venice Film Festival in August for An Officer and a Spy, which has been a big hit at the French box office despite a wave of protests. Now, some screenings had to be canceled after feminist protesters invaded or blockaded cinemas. The publicity campaign for the film was also halted after French photographer Valentine Monnier claimed that she had also been raped by the director in 1975. Monnier, an 18-year-old model and actress at the time, said that Polanski tried to give her a pill as he beat her into submission at the Swiss Chalet. Polanski absolutely denied assaulting Monnier, pouring scorn on her story. Obviously, I'm here to protest and whatever. So that's going to be another compelling story there as well. And let me just quickly look to see if there's anything else that we should look at. And okay, and this is, airlines have definitely suspended China flights amid the coronavirus fears. So it seems that already over 132 people have died from the coronavirus epidemic, which has infected around 6,000 people. And so the flight announcements came hours after some countries began airlifts of their nationals trapped in Wuhan, the quarantined central Chinese city of 11 million people at the epicenter of a health emergency. So that's the crisis there. And then we also have, this is interesting about Peru. Evidently, a Peruvian court orders the opposition leader, Keiko Fujimori, to return to prison. As Peruvian authorities detained opposition leader Keiko Fujimori yesterday night for a new 15-month jail trial, the politician published a pre-recorded video urging a petition and vowing to end her silence on the case. A judge on Tuesday afternoon ordered her detention as prosecutors continue an investigation of alleged money laundering. And she had already spent 13 months in jail, but Peru's top constitutional court ordered her release after November prosecutors appealed that decision. Wow. So we have to move on. And 1 second. Okay. So I think that that's where we are. And so I'm going to just wish you a good day. Tomorrow is Thursday. Let me quickly look and see who we have scheduled for tomorrow. Oh, we're going to be speaking with John and Lori Wiles. I don't remember which card they're going to be reviewing, but we'll notify you of that later on tonight. And I guess that's where we're at. So all the best. Thank you for being with us. What a pleasure. And thanks to Oren M. Levin-Waldman. He's always an eye-opener, no matter what. Okay. And, just in case people are wondering, Trump's Middle East peace plan evidently has delighted a lot of Israelis, but also I hear a lot that weren't delighted, and also enrages Palestinians. And I think there's also outrage as well in Israel, too. So we'll just see where this goes. And but I haven't been able to study all the ramifications of these concepts and ideas that they want to install. So it's going to be very interesting to see where that goes. All right, so that's our story from here. Let's just end this broadcast and we'll speak to you tomorrow. Okay. All right, so I think we're done. All right, let me just see here. Mm-hmm.